More than 60 episodes of this podcast, so-called normal, have focused on the experiences and insights of those living with, coping with, and managing their own mental health. And some have identified their challenges as mental illness, but many more have framed their mental health in the context of just the messiness of life. In this special four-part limited podcast series, you'll hear the remarkable story of Mark Hennick. We hear his own account of a suicide attempt at the age of 15. We hear the matter-of-fact story of his rescue. And we hear the personal story of an ordinary man who did the extraordinary. Here's your host, Mark Hennick.
My life, as I know it now, really didn't begin until I tried to end it. It was a cold, wet Cape Breton Sunday night, March 2003. This is the end, I thought. I was determined that it would be my end. I was in a state of focused, practiced determination. I had climbed over the railing of a bridge. I'd perched myself on an inch and a half of concrete on the wrong side in Sydney, Nova Scotia. I was fully prepared to launch myself out over the edge and to greet the ground below. I still, to this day, don't know how long I stood there. Time does funny things when you're distorted in your mind like this, but when I did let go, since there was practically nothing under my feet, I began to fall. I remember the ground coming toward me as I fell. And then I remember seeing the arm of a stranger. He was wearing a light brown jacket. As I looked down and saw the ground coming toward my face, I saw his arm wrap around my chest. And he pulled me backward against the railing so hard that it knocked the wind out of me and my feet flew up off of the edge. I dangled there for what seemed like forever. And then he pulled me back. I didn't know it then, but Mike Ritchie was my savior that night. Sure, he pulled me off of the edge of a bridge. He saved my life in that moment. But he actually ended up giving me my entire life from that moment. It'd be years before I would finally learn Mike's identity. And then when we finally did realize that the other person was still alive, it'd be many months more before we actually would reconnect in person in downtown Toronto. But when we did, I felt as if I had recognized him. As if we'd known each other all our lives, although we had only spent a few minutes together on that Sunday night in March in Cape Breton.
For me, it felt natural to just kind of like, I'm going to give him a hug. So you had put your hand out, I believe, just to like shake my hand, but right. I just grabbed and gave you a hug.
And I remember that being so significant. That was, for me, probably the most significant moment because that's right where we left off.
Yeah.
that's what you did the last time we were together, yeah. Right? In a very different context, yeah. Of course, but your arms were around me.
Yeah. And in that moment, that was another thing where for that brief moment, the camera in my mind, like the cameras weren't there for a minute, you know, working my way up. Of course, both of us are going to be nervous.
Sure.
I didn't know how I would feel. Just giving you a hug, and it felt like that was kind of the little bow on everything in that moment when it all kind of came together, and it was...
Yeah. I remember telling you that I didn't know how to thank you. I mean, I tell people this all the time. How do you thank someone for not just saving your life in a moment? Because I still don't know how long we were actually on the bridge that night. I don't think it was that long, but it seemed like a lot longer, you know, and it's occupied such large real estate, I think, in my memory and in my mind. But really, it was only probably a very brief moment. So how do you thank somebody not just for taking action in a brief moment, but for actually changing the course of your life ever since? You didn't just save my life. You gave me my whole life, right? Because when I left the hospital on that first day of spring, you know, I decided that I wanted to be like you, and I didn't even know if you were real.
And I don't need any thanks for any of that. That wasn't so, it was never done with the intentions of, like, being thanked or
right.
But for yourself, the best thanks that you could ever give is you doing exactly what you're doing with your life, which is helping other people, and as well as just for your own happiness. I met your family. You've got a great little family
there.
Well,
this is it. And, and that's what was so... It was like, well, I don't know how to thank them, so I'll just introduce them to everything.
Yeah.
Because that's what you made possible.
And that made me so happy. Like, there's nothing else you could have done that would have been... made it any better for me. So there's no thanks needed. That's awesome. So,
well, regardless of there not being any thanks needed, thank you.
You're welcome.
I want to talk a little bit more about what's happened since then. Before we met in Toronto, I mentioned I went back and I brought cameras along, of course, and I showed my mother the place where I had tried to jump, where you had saved me. Mm-hmm. Really found a good place, because I don't think that my parents, like, people ask me this all the time, what did your parents think about this point in your life? And I don't think they really understood, as many parents don't. But when I finally brought her back there, I think, and she was able to see, like you did, things from my perspective, and we were able to share that moment together. I think we did really close a loop, my mother and I, on the stuff that I had gone through, because I think she blamed herself for a lot of that, unjustifiably, but I think she did. Then I go back to Toronto, we meet, and she is able to see that reunion, mm-hmm. And then a few weeks later, she dies unexpectedly, very, very unexpectedly. We talk for an hour and a half, and this is when I get emotional when I talk about my mommy.
Right? That's understandable.
Mama's boy, right? mama issues. So we mentioned a few times all these weird coincidences all along, right? And then it's like we finally get to close the loop on this trauma, I think, that I had lived and then overcome, and then you being such a central part of making me successful, whatever that even means, and her finally being able to see that, and then basically leaving. Now I thought about that a lot, and I'm not entirely sure why I'm bringing this into the conversation, only to say that it feels like right when you get things figured out, like right when you and I reconnect and it gets to a good place and I'm like, yeah, this is awesome, and suddenly my life is inspiring, then shit gets real again and it all falls apart again, right? And in some ways, and I've thought about this a lot, I feel like I never really had the opportunity to develop a meaningful relationship with you after all this media stuff happened, partly because my life was so traumatically and unexpectedly interrupted again after mm-hmm. we met, right?
Yeah.
I tell people sometimes that you don't really realize how far you've come until you're forced to look back. And that was one of those traumatic moments that I think probably could have, if anything could have, sent me back to that place when I was struggling the most. And while it was no question the hardest thing that I've ever had to cope with in my life, it didn't ultimately send me back to that place. And I think it was only through that I realized that I'm not that kid on the bridge anymore.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that you played such a central role in that. And you reached out to me around when that happened. Mm-hmm. And your mother has been in contact with me a lot.
My mom's your biggest fan.
And I have this picture. It's been on my Facebook page now. And I never actually asked your mother's permission. I probably should have.
She's fine with
this. The header on my... I will change it eventually. But the header on my Facebook page at the time of this recording is my mother and your mother, who both came out to that event when I went home to Cape Breton before we actually met.
Another thing with when it comes down to everything with timing and how I'm so glad that my mom got to meet your mom.
Yeah.
And as I said, my mom thinks the world of you. I know you haven't had a chance to really, she follows everything that, like,
I think we've only met in person. She came to my mother's funeral, mm-hmm. which was extraordinarily meaningful for me to see her there, because it was just such a haze at that time. But outside of that, I think we only met that one time.
Yeah. Like, I think she spends a lot of time, like, on social media, that's, and kind of so following like kind of, you have like a public page, and mm-hmm. I don't know if you have her on a, like a personal.
We do. Yeah. Oh yeah. We're tight now. Yeah.
So there's odd things that, you know, I'll be just talking to her and she's just like, "Are you talking to Mark about blah, 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 blah?" And I'm like, I had no idea he did that or was like, she keeps up on what you're doing. Yeah, like as I said, I'm really glad that there was at least that time when my mom got to meet your mom, and you got to meet my mom, and every, you know, so it's.
And I remember that my mother was grateful for that as well, and I think they actually did connect a few times after that too, and my mother was active insofar as she knew how on Facebook and social media as well, and followed a lot of this stuff too. So.
And being from generally the same area and stuff, like most Cape Bretoners are their best friends after you meet for 10 minutes, you know, stuff like that. So,
well, I don't know why I felt compelled to bring that into it, but I think it's been nice to know your mother and to have her reach out randomly from time to time. Not to say that I know her, I really don't, but but it is nice to see her checking in, because there's so many parts of my past, I think, that I really tried to cut myself off from, because I didn't want to be that person anymore. Mm-hmm. And it was after my mother's death that I finally realized that I'm not that person anymore, but not because I'm running anymore either. It's just I've reintegrated it into something else. I've evolved into something
else. Come to this place naturally.
Exactly. Yeah. That it wasn't a breaking point. It wasn't a running as fast as I could, which is how I always thought that I needed to deal with my emotions and my traumas and my struggles and my past, was run far and run fast and never look back. And that doesn't work out so well.
So, I mean, now do you feel after having such, like, as you said, things are going great, and then life just kind of beats you down again. Yeah. And you have this traumatic event happen, but yet you don't slip back into that dark place. And I mean, obviously, it wasn't easy. Do you kind of have a weight lifted off your shoulders in the sense, like, I think I'm actually going to be okay? There's going to be lots of bad days, but I'm going to be all right.
It's funny you mention that, because without question, losing my mother was, even with all the other stuff, all the other hospitalizations, the being strapped down, getting the needle, the Haldol needle, I think I was in a straitjacket at one point. Like they do all kinds of weird and barbaric things, and not to scare anybody away from getting help in this former system, because not my experience isn't everybody's, but from all the stuff I'd been through, you know, the abuses and the bullying and the harassment and the stuff at home, and I was, you know, molested, which is in the book, but I've never talked about, like, all this trauma that I had accumulated in my life, that was way worse. Losing my mother was way worse. That was the worst thing I'd ever experienced. It's not like it was suddenly, okay, but I can handle it this time. I didn't know that at the time. It was 2 years of struggle. And I remember at the 1 year mark after my mother died thinking, okay, but now I don't really have an excuse for being sad anymore, because it's not the first Christmas without her anymore. It's not the first birthday without her anymore. Now it's the second. And for some reason that felt less significant in some way, almost like I wasn't allowed to still be grieving. When, of course, my mother died very suddenly, we didn't know she was sick. We got a call one morning and she had died the night before. I would say I'd always relapsed in my depression at least once a year ever since that time. But over time, I got better and better at managing it, recognizing, you know, that it was coming, recognizing when I needed to kick in my self-care plan, such as it was, and dragging myself out of it. And I tell people sometimes that I've gotten really good at being depressed because you learn how to do it after a while, I guess. And that's okay. Yep. You know, you don't want to run from it. You want to integrate it into your life, I think. So I think when I finally got through, for me, the intense 2 years of grief, looking back and realizing that if I can get through that I can get through anything. With what I've been through so far, whatever I encounter in the future, those feelings of anguish, of it'll never get better, that I remind myself constantly now that this too shall pass, that it always passes. Mm-hmm. That if that could pass, it still hurts, but I'm still alive. I'm still going, right? And, you know, I don't think I would have had the opportunity to learn that if people like you and so many like you, you know, you in that instant, but really it happened for me so many times, were so stubbornly intent on keeping me alive. Like, what? It's just, it's like every friggin' time I want to go, there's somebody taking me back, somebody pulling me back. And it's like, just let me go sometimes. But then but that's great, because it's that every time I try to give up on myself, there's other people who won't let me. And I'm the type of person who I think needs that. So, you know, and I think now it's just happened so many times that I've been conditioned into knowing and into believing that I'm going to be here tomorrow and probably the day after that, no matter what happens. So
that's amazing.
Yeah. And I don't want you to undervalue the fact that you do that for kids every single day. You've been working in this field for now 15 years, yeah. Right? Doing this for kids all the time.
And in that line of work too, it's you don't really always get a chance to see any of the impacts that you've made. It's just kind of you're with the youth in their day-to-day lives.
Yeah.
So the fact that they're teenagers and they have a lot to go through yet, it could be, the longer you're in the field, I think you get more, there's more chances of getting a random phone call from someone who's now 22 or 20, you know, one, and they're having a child and they want to share like a special moment in their life with a particular person who, when they were 14 or 15, living in group care, yeah. That maybe there was some little thing that myself and other youth care workers do, you know, just all the time, just whether it's getting someone, being comforting, in whatever that may look like, but just getting them a snack or getting them anything, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we never know what impact that's going to have until right. much later on, because it could have been, you'll hear stories like, you know, kids will say, they'll come back years later and say, you were the only one that did blah, blah, blah. And you don't remember it because it's just kind of what you do for all the youth that would need that in any given moment. But yeah. to that particular young person, that was extremely important. It was what they needed at that time, but you never know.
Right.
So there's just kind of, you just have to go about your day and just kind of do the best work that you can do and hope that you can make these young people as safe and happy as a stretch, but right. comfortable.
What advice would you give to other people, whether they're, you know, mental health workers, youth workers, or just everyday people, just a parent mm-hmm. or a friend, a coworker, whatever, what would you tell them or what would you suggest they do when they're concerned that somebody might be suicidal or depressed or struggling?
Basically, the easiest way I can answer it, I guess, is just if you see an opportunity to help a person, just do it. You don't have to be trained in, or, you know, have any formal education. Everyone can see when someone is clearly in distress. A lot of times you can't. Mm. But when you do see those signs, it doesn't hurt to reach out. It doesn't hurt to just check in. It doesn't hurt to at least make an effort for that person to know that you're there. And it doesn't have to be as dramatic as pulling them off a bridge or right. anything like that. But it could be a look. It could be just the way somebody, you can tell someone's just having an off day. Yeah. Check in with them. Just talk to people.
Yeah. And that was, I think, the most significant thing that you did to me, that you didn't come in and grab me, right? At least not right away. You didn't come in and try to diagnose me. You didn't run down the Beck depression inventory with me. And I pretty much had it memorized by that point anyway. Remember, I was a frequent flyer. You know, I could tell by your voice and the way you talk that you weren't a mental health professional, explicitly speaking, you know, mm-hmm. a psychiatrist or a psychologist or something, because yeah. I talked to them all. Right? But what you did that was most impactful for me was just be a normal person. You were a human being with a heartbeat. That's all that really, that's what connected with me, I think.
And I think that's the core of just, you know, what I was saying is we're all human beings. We all have emotions. We all we're afraid. You know, we all get depressed and sad. If you have the opportunity just to be that person for somebody, don't assume someone else is going to do it. Just, yeah. it doesn't take anything just to say, you know, how's your day go? Are you okay? Or it doesn't even have to be that. Just maybe you're the only person that's around. Be yeah. with them. You know, just be there.
Sometimes
be
just a smile or a hug or and don't assume. I tell people, I tell this to parents a lot too, even though they seem to know it better than anybody else. don't assume that people know that you love them and therefore don't tell them.
Mm-hmm.
If anything, tell them too much.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah.
Now, what would you say to, and actually you probably do this all the time, a young person who is going through the struggle themselves, that they don't know what to do or if it'll ever get better. What do you say to anybody who's listening to this who might be looking for hope on the other side of this struggle?
In terms of being a young person, it's hard to get them to see beyond right now. That's probably one of the biggest struggles, is that as an adult you see you don't want to make, in your mind, some of their struggles may seem trivial because it's just like, oh, you know, we've all gone through that sort of thing.
But they haven't,
right. And that's not helpful in that sense. So you don't want to trivialize their experiences in the moment. So in terms of what to say to somebody, I don't have a general blanket statement, but
nor should you, I think.
So it's very much a case by case thing with me and the relationship I have with a person, in terms of how I would approach giving them any sort of direction or advice, if any at all. It's not as easy as saying, you know, oh, it'll get better, because that's...
You don't know.
Yeah.
You don't know my life. Tomorrow's another day, right? Yeah. If you're super depressed, that's the problem. Tomorrow's another day.
and people are very awkward that haven't even had an opportunity maybe to think of things that way.
Right.
So they want to be helpful, but they might not be saying helpful things. They might be kind of being counterproductive with what they're shooting for because someone doesn't necessarily want to hear that things are going to get better, because that's not helping me right now.
Right.
Like, I feel like the worst I've ever felt in this moment. Yeah. I don't care about tomorrow.
Right.
I don't care. So
sometimes you just need somebody to say, yeah, that really sucks.
Yeah.
And it's okay that it sucks. Of course it sucks.
Yep. And I personally use that one a lot, as you just said it. Like, I acknowledge what's happening right now.
Yeah.
So I don't try to spin things. I know... Part of my job is we're supposed to always focus on the positives, but I think the acknowledging the negatives can be more impactful by just saying, like, yeah, this is awful right now, you know, and I don't have any magic fixes, but I'm acknowledging how you're feeling, and you know, that's totally valid, and you have every right to feel how you feel right now. Yeah. So,
and that you must notice that just open up. Help to open people up so much when they realize that somebody sees them in that way.
I think it does, and with some of the youth that I work with, and sometimes they'll flat out tell you, maybe not in that moment, but after the fact, that you know, you or someone else, like, were a few of the people that actually, they didn't try to like cheer me up or like they just, and I work with a lot of great people, so. You know, I don't want it to seem like this is just something that just I do. It's not just me. So, I mean, just acknowledging and respecting where a person is at emotionally at any given time is probably the most important thing in terms of how I would approach anything, really. Yeah.
Well, it worked for me. So, Mike, again, thank you for saving my life. Thank you for giving me my whole life. And thank you for coming on my podcast.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Mike.
No problem.
When I was standing on the edge of that bridge, ready to kill myself, I was absolutely convinced that it was what I had to do. I was hopeless. I was helpless. I thought that I was broken, that it was my cross to bear. I was wrong, but I didn't know that. Because it's how I felt, and isn't that all that really matters? This is the end, I thought. I was convinced that there was no other life beyond that moment. That's been on my mind a lot lately, that idea of endings, but for a very different reason. You see, this is the end of my so-called normal podcast over the last year, that I've published now 65 episodes with fascinating conversations with celebrities like Rosie O'Donnell and Glenn Close, writers like Andrew Solomon and Neil Pasricha, musicians like Jimmy Rankin and Biff Naked, and so many other people, broadcasters, writers, experts in various fields. It's been such a privilege to get to know their stories, to get to know the nuance of their story. My entire project in this so-called Normal podcast has been breaking down the silos, not only within the mental health space, always hearing from the same people, and we've had a few of those people on too, but the silo around the idea of mental health, that it can only be clinical, that it's only a something that's wrong with you. I want to approach it a little bit in a bit more of a complex way, and we've been able to draw that out in so many different ways from so many different people. I set out 1 year ago on Bell Let's Talk Day when we launched it to have those kinds of nuanced conversations. I set out to do 50 of them, and we're going to end at 65, so I think we've accomplished that goal. Now it's time for me to do something else. Does that mean that I'm done telling stories, mine or anybody else's? Well, no, it doesn't. I've got my book coming out at the end of this year. I'm doing another master's degree. I'm an active public speaker. I love being on stages and being able to draw out the emotional reactions of people to real life stories. That's all we all really want. Authentic real life stories that are nuanced and interesting and compelling. So I'm not done. And as I learned all those years ago from a stranger in a light brown jacket, a stranger named Mike, a stranger who would not let me die, I learned from Mike that night on that bridge that this is not the end. This is just the beginning. I'm Mark Hennick. This has been So-Called Normal. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a special episode of So-Called Normal with Mark Hennick. If you like what you heard, share the episode with others. You can always follow Mark on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, YouTube, and Instagram at Mark Hennick. Otherwise, you might want to check out his website, markhennick.com. This special series of So-Called Normal has been produced by Mark Hennick and Eye Contact Productions. I'm Dave Trafford.